the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere, sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Frank Sinatra, and this is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World, which originates right here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Last night, those of you who are Sinatra fans, and that's probably everyone, HBO last night aired their first 2 hours of a semi-autobiographical four-hour documentary on Francis. I watched it. I will watch the second part, which airs tonight on HBO, beginning at 8 o'clock. I was particularly interested since I knew him so well, and we were almost in business together, and I wrote for him for about 4 years. I was interested in two aspects of his life that they failed to touch on last night, so I'll be watching it tonight for those next 2 hours to see if they touch on it then. And if they don't touch on it then the next time we meet, folks, I will be telling you the stories that the documentary failed to tell you. But some of the stuff is really interesting, especially those moments when Sinatra is seated by himself and talking by himself about his life, his music, and his career. He's intensely sincere and terribly honest about it. But maybe the best is to come tonight around 8 o'clock, and I certainly hope so. Anyway, I am totally non-religious, and this past Easter weekend, I was delighted, quite by accident, to bump into a show on the Golf Channel, strangely enough. This next week is the week of the Masters, and Augusta National has started a program for children 15 and under. It's a competition called the Dry Putt and Chip Championship, and they aired it over Easter. And what they did, aside from having the kids doing what it is they do with golf balls and golf clubs, they gave you background videos of these amazing youngsters, and there must have been 20 or 30 of them, and they were all fabulously bright and multi-talented and committed kids. And it made me feel so good, because if these kids with these backgrounds and interests, which are astounding, if they grow into adults without losing it, then like Allstate, America might be in good hands once again. And I thought I would continue my search for enlightenment on the Easter weekend by going to Fox in the hopes of finding Judge Napolitano. Judge Napolitano is the deodorizer in the outhouse that is Fox. And you wouldn't believe how my weekend was ruined by these two blonde talking boneheads. Well, to say that Fox News is filled with blondes, because they're all blondes, is like saying, I think the dog has fleas. But these two talking boneheads, they were quoting Ecclesiastes, the Bible, saying that Jesus would send the poor to hell, to burn in hell, for not pulling their weight, which is true. The devil can quote scriptures to his own ends. And these blondes were encouraging Republican conservative congressmen on this religious day celebrating Jesus. They were encouraging these Republicans to vote down food stamps for the poor. And if they didn't completely eliminate food stamps, then they should put in there a provision that says the poor with these food stamps would not be able to buy steaks. Jesus Christ. Well, this little tidbit of information is to all these blonde-talking boneheads and you Fox News fanatics and Republican born-agains who are trying to hammer the poor and truly needy further in the name of Jesus. Jesus was not a conservative. He was a radical. He was a radical member of the Essenes, a cult, a sect, a devout religious cult that owned everything in common. Did you hear that? They owned everything in common. In other words, your Christ was a commie. The world and the country would be a much more peaceful and pleasant place if all of you believers practiced your religions in private instead of preaching it and pushing it on us. Do you know, because of you, in Indiana, hundreds of geniuses, from Michelangelo to Cole Porter, could not get a pizza. But one pizza parlor said, he just announced, that they would be pleased to serve gays, toasted with tomatoes and olives. My God. And then today, Pat Robertson on his show is screaming into the camera, as only Pat Robertson can. He said, no child was ever conceived through anal sex. Well, Reverend Robertson, you are entirely wrong. George Bush, a piece of crap if there ever was one. And speaking of that, we got one in our own state. You may have heard the announcement that Senator Harry Reid is not running for re-election again. Well, Harry not running for re-election again is like the government telling us there's one less drop of fluoride in our polluted water. It is amazing now how many ordinary Republicans and Americans and Democrats are now comparing our government to the mafia, and unfavorably. And the one big difference between the mafia and the government is that with the government, the crime is unorganized. And for the next 2 years, we're going to be drowning in a tsunami of ordinariness about the two-headed one-party system in this country and the presidential candidates. So my position for the next 2 years on American presidential politics will be lying down under the covers. Oh, and you may have noticed also that the Los Angeles Times reported the grandson of billionaire J. Paul Getty was found dead in his mansion in Los Angeles with severe damage to his rectal area. If anyone knows who did this, would you please send Ted Nugent's address to him? And you know, for me, there are a few intellectuals and politicians I've sort of admired over the last few years, but it's being diminished. That's Noam Chomsky and Elizabeth Warren and Ron Paul, and I won't go into it. And one of the reasons that my beliefs in them is sort of diminished is they're still living and working in the United States of America, when it seems to me the Americans I enjoy listening to are trying to tell us the truth about what's going on, like Ed Snowden, Ken O'Keefe, Glenn Greenwald, Jesse Ventura, and filmmaker Laura Poitras, and a few others have had to move out of the country. But fortunately for us, we still have a handful toughing it out and touching us in America. One, I'm thrilled to say, is my guest tonight. So grab a pencil and a piece of paper, because he is going to give you a list of books that will blow and grow your mind. And those of you who wish to talk to him, you can call in toll-free at 888-607-6008. That's 888-607-6008. I first saw him a year ago on Book Notes on C-SPAN. I immediately wrote down my list, and I wrote to George Knapp and a few other talk show hosts with large audiences, urging them to book him because he deserves to be heard. He is a professor of media studies at New York University, author himself of three terrific books, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Elections, Boxed In, what a great title, The Culture of Television, and Mad Scientist, sounds like a Stanley Kramer movie, with Peter Sellers. The Study of War Propaganda, and it's another must-read. For what he is doing now, and the reason for his appearance a year ago on C-SPAN, he deserves, if there is such a thing, a Pulitzer Prize for public service. He has created an absolutely compelling project called Forbidden Bookshelf, assembling books that have been censored and deliberately overlooked because of the uncomfortable truths they tell us about our country, our government, ourselves, and our secret agencies. Here to enlighten us and inform us, Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
I'm floored by this introduction. I hope I can do it justice. Thanks a million for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Well, you certainly deserve to be heard. And Mark, I have an absolute and total fascination in people and how they end up where they are in their lives and if they're doing what they always set out to do. I mean, in your case, were you always interested in words? Were you always interested in writing? Were you always interested in what was going on around you? Or as a kid, did you want to play for the Yankees or the New York Rangers?
No, I never had any athletic aspirations. I guess I was always interested in writing and acting and the arts generally. And yet I ended up a professor at NYU. But I have to say that I came kind of late to the project that I've been engaged in really for the last couple of decades, which is basically trying to, salvage what's left of American democracy and realize the promise of our system, because it's never been genuinely democratic, and it's been growing less and less so over the years, especially since 9/11.
What prompted that news for you, since you started it before 9/11, obviously?
Well, I don't
and
know.
And were you an actor?
Well, I was as a kid. I was in shows in school, and I was very interested in film, I don't know how this happened, but I ended up in graduate school in English, and my specialty was Shakespeare. And this is in the 70s, but while I was doing that work for credit and a degree, I was sort of on my own writing about the media, about movies and so on, for magazines, that had a non-academic readership. Uh-huh. And I became increasingly interested in the media through the late 70s and into the 80s. I was a TV critic for the New Republic for a while, and I wrote for the New York Review of Books and so on. And the more I studied it, and the more TV came to kind of absorb politics, which had been happening for a while and reached a certain kind of climax with the Reagan years, when the presidency became a kind of deliberate TV spectacle.
As a critic at the time, do you ever remember reading Gary Deeb out of the Chicago Tribune?
I did read him. Yeah, because I'm from Chicago.
Oh, how wonderful! Gary and I became close friends years ago, and I must say, I'm sorry I'm misreading some of your reviews, but Gary, I felt, had the the greatest one-line review of American television I ever read, and that was back in the late 70s, early 80s. He said, television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product.
That's a good line.
Is that wonderful?
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Yeah, that's a good line.
And as a former critic myself, I was 10 years with Los Angeles Magazine and 5 years with KNBC in Los Angeles. I have enormous affection for critics, but I have greater affection for writers.
Yeah,
so
right.
Then you started this movement, you say, to realizing, because of Reagan, I guess. I mean, it was Reagan. When I started in television, Mark, they had the fairness doctrine.
Yeah, right.
And I had Reagan on one of my very first shows in Los Angeles, and because of having him on the show, I then had to have a Democrat, and if a socialist got 5% of the vote, I had to have a socialist. And I remember we had a Nazi on the show. And as someone who was hosting a news information show, you were never, ever allowed to express an opinion. When Reagan got in, he scuttled the fairness doctrine, and without that happening, there would have never been a Fox News.
Well, that was an extremely important move by the right, and corporate America too was involved in this to make the media more accessible to them and more expressive of their interests and less responsive to the population at large. It wasn't just the elimination of the fairness doctrine. It was the deregulation of the media across the board, which started under Reagan and culminated under Clinton. You know, I have to say it's a bipartisan achievement. The utter corruption of our media system. You know, I think we probably have the worst mainstream news in the developed world. And a lot of this has to do with the deregulation of American broadcasting. Aside from the, getting rid of the fairness doctrine, there was also the elimination of caps on station ownership. You know, originally, I think that no single entity could own more than 3 radio stations. This is back in 1934. And steadily over the years, those regulations have been watered down. Now we have a world in which, you know, a Clear Channel can own in excess, I think, of 1,200 radio stations.
When I originated the AM show in Los Angeles, which was the first news information show ABC did locally in Los Angeles, ABC could only own 7 stations.
Right.
And the Los Angeles Times could not own a television station if they had a newspaper. And
that's
as
right.
You say, and I sort of, you know, when intellectuals are evil, and I have to say it's a banality of evil, is that next to John Kennedy, I would say, because he was a Rhodes Scholar, that Clinton was probably the most intelligent president. But because he did what he did, which was certainly scuttling the FCC regulations allowing ownership, his repeal of Glass-Steagall, which allowed the banks and Wall Street to steal America,
right?
Waco, which was absolutely, totally, totally unnecessary. I believe that Bill Clinton was the absolute worst president the United States has ever had. And Mark, the reason I respond so much to what you're doing with Forbidden Bookshelf is these books are so interesting, but it's like it's fading away from us and we'll never get the country back.
Well, never say never, you know. One thing I've learned is that you can't really accurately gauge how people generally think and feel from the media spectacle. In other words, we can't infer from that, you know, horrific tableau of one idiocy after another. We can't really infer how people think and feel from the from that, because people don't necessarily agree with or even enjoy what they're watching. I mean, Clinton is a very interesting example. You know, during Whitewater and that whole Monica Lewinsky thing, which I think we can agree was, you know, completely irrelevant and was kind of a right-wing venture, you know, meant to derail his presidency, which I share your view of that presidency. But the interesting thing, just for the sake of our conversation here, is that you could not escape, if you wanted to, the constant kind of demonizing propaganda about him that was whipped up by Ken Starr and company.
That's right.
And yet, despite that, you know, despite that nonstop, all-pervasive propaganda spectacle against him, a majority of the American people continued to support him, you know, which I think is interesting.
Well, that was a triumph, as in the case of Ronald Reagan, of personality over program.
Well,
he's an immensely charming man. Ronald Reagan is an immensely charming man. But I must tell you, I interviewed him for an hour, and it was like trying to find out what he really believed was like trying to shovel smoke. He didn't exist. And after the show, we took the tape into our office and we put it up because we thought, God, that guy doesn't exist. But I must tell you, Mark, on television, he was astonishing.
Well, he was, but I want to jump in here and make a point that I've really just made, and I want to apply it to him. You know, just as Clinton had a lot more support than you would think he'd have, given what everybody was hearing and watching about him. Likewise with Reagan. You know, we have heard endlessly about his extraordinary popularity. This is one of the memes of mainstream news mythology, is that Reagan was this extraordinarily popular president. There is no doubt that he had the kind of gifts you're referring to as an actor, and he was extraordinarily telegenic. All true, but he wasn't that popular, you know? He just wasn't that popular. He did win election overwhelmingly, that's true. But if you look at the actual statistics, you know, his approval ratings over the years, they really weren't that high. So, you know, I guess all I'm struggling to say here is that people actually often think for themselves, or at least are better able to sense what's really going on than you would think from just sitting down and watching Fox News, for example, or for that matter, CNN, you know, because sometimes I don't see that much difference between them. But, I mean, one of the reasons why this is so important to me is that the books we're doing in this series have to do with things like the Kennedy assassination. You know, if you look at the number of people who are actually not convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, you know, it's a majority of the American people by now. If you look at the percentages on how many people don't trust electronic voting, which is an issue that means a great deal to me, you find that there again, it's at least like half the population that people don't trust electronic voting, even though the whole subject of election fraud through electronic means has been completely forbidden. You know, it's a taboo subject. It's been relegated to the category of conspiracy theory. You can't talk about it. Nevertheless, despite that, people have enough sense, you know, to realize that a computerized voting system that's in private hands, which is what we have, is simply not trustworthy, you know. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is it is possible to get the country back, even though it seems like such a long shot now. On the other hand, you know, just before the fall of the Soviet Union, no one saw that coming. I mean, famously, even our own CIA didn't see it coming. It seemed
That's
as if
true.
That system was going to last forever. But the fact is that it was on an extremely weak foundation, you know. And I sometimes think that our system is on an extremely weak foundation.
Well, the major difference during the Cold War, and then quickly, this is, I'm so glad you mentioned the Kennedy assassination, because I accidentally read Jim Garrison's book about the Clay Shaw trial, Heritage of Stone, and try to get him booked on the AM show in Los Angeles. And in spite of the fact I had won my first Emmy there, we were bumping heads with the Today Show with a staff of four or five people as soon as I booked him. And he agreed to do it reluctantly. And then he said, "You'll never get away with it," which proved prophetic because once I booked him, they fired me. But when I was talking to him long distance on the phone to book him, he said at the time, see, arrested Clay Shaw in 67 and tried him in 69. And I always believed what the media was telling me, but I kept telling my friends, you know, if this guy Garrison is such a nut, why doesn't the government get out of his way and let him fall on his face in a courtroom? But they did everything to interfere with the trial. But what you were saying about public is he told me that in 1969, the Harris survey pointed out that 81% of Americans, that's in 69, just 5 years after the Warren Report, 81% of Americans either did not believe Oswald did it or that he couldn't have done it alone. And yet he went on to say about Americans, but only 23% wanted a new Warren Commission. And he said, "What does that tell you?" And I said, "Mr. Garrison, it says to me, I know what my mother and father did in the back seat of the car or when they got drunk or in the alley, but don't ever tell me my mother's not a virgin." Well, he screamed and he said, "God, what a great title for a book," which eventually will be a book. But I'm so interested to hear you say that, and that you're mentioning that some of your books in Forbidden Bookshelf are about the assassination. Now, it comes a time when you're going to start this project. How long ago did you start it? And what was the first book you picked that you felt we should see?
Well, it started last summer, and we didn't start with one book. We started with a number of books. One of them was The Phoenix Program by Douglas Valentine.
Vietnam.
That's right. That was a covert CIA program of assassination, torture, and surveillance, assassination, and torture of civilians in South Vietnam. It's an enormous program that went on for years, and resulted in the deaths of at least 20,000 Vietnamese civilians, maybe twice that number. This book by Doug Valentine is an indispensable study of that program that is based on his extensive interviews with all of the participants in it, that is, the CIA officers all talked to him about it. And the story of how that happened is an interesting one, but people can read it in his new introduction to the book. It's not only without doubt the best book on that program, and therefore a really indispensable book about the CIA, but it's also one of the best books written on the war in Vietnam. And indeed, the CIA tried very hard to prevent his finishing it.
It's probably more topical today than it was then, because that was the first book you mentioned on C-SPAN, and that's the first book I wrote down. And it's the first book I got, and I'm thrilled it did. Mark, do you mind if we take a quick break and continue when we come back?
Sure, sure.
Thank you so much. We'll be right back with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
I love you.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Now the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
I'd like to thank George Knapp, the best host on Coast to Coast, for that terrific unsolicited review of our documentary, The Last Word on the Assassination. You can get it at Amazon, as well as read dozens of other terrific unsolicited reviews, and some from some very famous people, including Oliver Stone and Jesse Ventura. And also, while you're there, for just a couple of bucks, you might want to pick up John Barber's Uncensored Facebook, Volume 1, with a terrific intro by Richard Belzer. You can open it any place and find something that'll make you laugh or think it's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. Anyway, I'm thrilled to be back and talking to Mark Crispin Miller, who has this fantastic project called Forbidden Bookshelf. Mark, welcome back, and please continue, because I must tell you, I was so stirred by that Booker you recommended, Operation Phoenix, because back in 1977, I was doing a local show on NBC. It was sort of a poor man's Johnny Carson show at night. And there was a documentary made about Vietnam called Hearts and Mind, funded by Columbia.
I remember
Columbia refused to release it because it told too many truths about Vietnam. There's this great line from General Patton's son, who's now a general in Vietnam, bragging about he's turned these great, clean-cut American boys into terrific killers, which is something American parents and mothers and fathers didn't want to hear, so they wouldn't release it. I only read about it when I read the Congressional Record. I called the producer, Bob Rafelson, who did two great films with Jack Nicholson, Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider. And I asked Bob if he would come on the show and bring some clips so we could show these clips and maybe force Columbia to release the film. He said, John, I got a better story. I said, what's that? He said, this kid, John Gabron. I said, who's this? He says, this is the kid that the SWAT squad and the helicopter swooped down on at Griffith Park when he had a flashback and claimed he had been an assassin for the CIA in Vietnam. So they arrested the kid. They had sent him to Letterman Hospital in San Francisco. And I said, you mean I could get him as a guest? He says, yes, my lawyer is his lawyer, and I'll bail him out. We took John Gabron back to Griffith Park where he'd had this flashback, to the spots where he had the rifle and was shooting at people. And he remembered vividly the names of the people that the CIA and intelligence gave him of the people he had to shoot. And he shot 20 or 30 of them. Of course, afterwards, the government swept down on them. They sent him back to Letterman. So I was really moved by that book. And I'd like you to mention a few more of these books. because they're just fabulous.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm still talking about the first, like, five books that we did. So there's Douglas Valentine's The Phoenix Program. Let me just interject. I want to make clear to your listeners that these are e-books, okay? They're not books. I'm sorry about that because I'm a great fan of actual physical books, but it's simply not economically feasible to do them as hard copies. So these are e-books that you can order, from Amazon or any of your favorite book vendors, and you can get to the whole list of all the books we've done so far by going to forbiddenbookshelf.com. So I'll return to, a sort of description of each of the titles. Last summer when we did the Phoenix program, we also did Christopher Simpson's book Blowback from 1988, which is the first and still by far the best study of America's recruitment of Nazis and fascists after World War II, and the effect that this recruitment had ultimately on American foreign and domestic policy. Christopher Simpson's a historian at American University, the author of three very important books, all of which we are doing in the series. And Blowback is absolutely essential, for one thing, because it sheds light on what's going on in Ukraine now at American hands. Government in Kiev is heavily tainted by neo-Nazis, and some of the battalions that they've been sending into East Ukraine to attack the population there.
Was that Operation Paperclip? Is that what it was called after the war?
Operation Paperclip is one of the operations that Christopher Simpson talks about in Blowback. There is a book that came out recently about Operation Paperclip. And it's an okay book, but actually Christopher Simpson's book is a better one, I have to say. I mean, I'm biased because we're republishing the book, but it is an essential volume for anybody who's concerned about a chapter of American history that too few of us know about. A third book that we did last summer is Dan Moldea's book Interference, which is about the relationship between organized crime and the National Football League. This is a book, yeah, absolutely. Now, this book, let me say, when it first came out in 1996, Keith Olbermann said that it is the best book on sports in the language. That's what he said about it. It is a fabulous book about the National Football League. Now, in the book, Dan predicted that sports writers close to the NFL would attack him for writing about this. And indeed, what happened was that a sports writer at the New York Times wrote a maliciously negative review of the book in the New York Times Book Review, so malicious and so inaccurate that Dan sued him over it. And that suit ended up in the Supreme Court. Now, Dan's argument was, book reviewers ought to be held to the same standard of factual accuracy as news reporters, which strikes me as a perfectly reasonable argument.
Great.
Well, he lost. He lost at the Supreme Court. So basically what happened was that book had the review had its intended effect. It killed sales. You know, it induced the publisher to cut back his advertising budget. They didn't do a paperback edition. So we're thrilled to bring the book back again, because Dan Moldea is a really first-rate crime reporter, and that's not the only book of his we're doing. Fourth book that came out last summer, and this is fascinating because it's the oldest book that we've brought back, and it's been selling better than any of the others. It came out in 1935. Okay.
Oh my!
It's called The Lords of Creation by Frederick Lewis Allen, who was a very popular. He was a popular historian back in the. He was an editor of Harper's Magazine, and some of his more famous books, like Born Yesterday and Only Yesterday, have stayed in print ever since they came out.
He wrote Born Yesterday?
Yeah, he wrote Born Yesterday.
The film that Broderick Crawford and Judy
Holliday? No, not Born Yesterday. only yesterday.
Oh, okay.
No, not the. Yeah, if I said that, I misspoke. I'm crazy about that movie, but that was not the title. The Lords of Creation is a history of the kind of financialization of the American economy from the turn of the 20th century up till the Depression when the book came out. It's all about how J.P. Morgan and the rest of them, basically took over the American economy.
Is it anything like Jekyll Island?
Jekyll Island. No, I don't think that in itself comes up in the book.
Okay.
But it's a kind of an indispensable book. It's like a companion volume to another book that came out in the 30s that I'm hoping we can also do called The Robber Barons by Matthew Josephson. The Lords of Creation was extremely popular when it came out. We have a new introduction by Gretchen Morgenson, who's a terrific financial reporter for the New York Times. And, the book is just as relevant today as it was in 1935, you know.
When you were getting people to do the foreword to that book, and what a great title, The Lords of Creation, did you approach somebody like Naomi Klein?
I've actually approached Naomi Klein about writing the introduction to another book that we are doing called Friendly Fascism by Bertram Gross. This is a book we are bringing out, and I'm hoping I can get Naomi to write the introduction, but, you know, I don't know if she will. But since you asked, I thought I would say that.
Sure she would.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And this Lords of Creation is selling better than your other books?
Yeah, it's actually doing – the last I checked with – it's Open Road Integrated Media is the name of the company that's doing the series. The last I checked with them about how sales are going, they told me the Lords of Creation is still our top seller.
You mentioned, Mark, that it was published in 1935. You know, back in those years – and even as far back as, I guess, as the 50s and the 60s, there were all kinds of progressive or radical, well-written magazines and newspapers. You know, I was never really very political, but I was always interested in good writing and good stories. And I never missed an issue of I.F. Stone's Weekly. Do you remember that?
Well, not only do I remember it, but I'm proud to say that we have now done two of his books. You want me to go on? I mean,
absolutely. You're kidding.
I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. let me quickly mention.
Meeting you is like meeting a kid I used to play hockey with.
That's great. Well, let me just quickly mention the fifth book we did last summer in the first tranche of five titles. I mentioned this book with a certain emphasis because it hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. It's an extremely important book called The Search for an Abortionist that came out in 1969 by a sociologist named Nancy Howell Lee. It's a classic study of how women coped with unwanted pregnancies, and this is 1969. This is 4 years before Roe v. Wade, and it's a very even-handed book. It's not any kind of like pro-choice screed. It's simply an objective study of all the different ways in which women dealt with their unwanted pregnancies when abortion was illegal. It is actually a book.
I must tell you something, Mark. As you say this, no matter who you are out there listening, whether you're conservative, non-conservative, religious, or non-religious, you are going to remember back to a time when either you got pregnant or somebody you were with got pregnant, and you were looking for a way to terminate it. I must tell you, Mark, I've met hundreds of them, and I'm telling you, it must be a terrific and moving book.
It is. It's very moving. And it is really, this sounds like a self-serving thing to say, but it's true that whichever side of that debate you're on, you're really obliged to read the book because it's just a truthful, impartial account of the reality of life on such a landscape. You know, we're heading in that direction now. I mean, we're more than halfway there, despite the fact that we have Roe v. Wade on the books, you know, because the Christian right has done such a good job of making abortions extremely difficult for, you know, women who don't have a lot of money.
And you just said that you were going to publish two of Izzy Stone's.
That's right. That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that. And maybe I'll touch on two more that I read all the time 30-some-odd years ago. One was Paul Krasner's Realist, and then Ramparts Magazine.
Ramparts, yeah. Ramparts was just like a miracle, you know. I mean, we could so use Ramparts today.
Yes,
anyway, the first of Izzy Stone's books that we brought back is in many ways his best book. It's The Hidden History of the Korean War, which came out in 1952.
First of all, tell the audience a little bit about who Izzy Stone was and why he did his weekly.
Yes, well, that has everything to do with this book. Izzy Stone was a left-wing journalist who was a kind of relentless researcher. You know, he based his investigative work on extremely close readings of government documents. He was in Washington, but he was not of Washington. You know, he never cultivated any of the people in the power structure there. He didn't schmooze with them. He didn't lunch with them. He didn't go to their homes because he knew that if he did, he couldn't write objectively about what they were up to. Well, he was actually a fairly successful writer with a considerable following until he published The Hidden History of the Korean War. Now, this is a book that dozens of American publishers rejected. He couldn't get this thing accepted for publication until finally the Monthly Review Press, which was kind of a Marxist house in New York, agreed to put it out. What Stone does in the book is it reads like a novel. It's absolutely riveting. He tells the true story of how the Korean War, not only how it started, but how America, you know, Douglas MacArthur, the Truman administration, the Republican Party, and various other actors did everything they could to keep that war going. Every time peace threatened to break out, they found a way to keep it going. And this is for a number of reasons, partisan reasons, economic reasons, and so on. But the fact is that the Korean War jump-started the military-industrial complex. It was essential that it had to keep going. And he tells the story of how that happened in a way that's just absolutely unforgettable. But when the book came out...
That's probably the reason for the extended Cold War, because Roosevelt did not end unemployment when the war was over. There were 2 or 3 million people in the service, and the owners of the country are probably thinking, well, you know, how many refrigerators can we make, or how many toasters can we make, how many water heaters can we make? And Jim Garrison told me repeatedly he was convinced the war, he said, and you mentioned earlier the collapse of the Soviet Union, which nobody saw because it was an unsound system. But the difference between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War is that every dollar that we spent on a bullet was profit. And General Eisenhower spoke about it, sadly, when he was leaving office, the military-industrial complex. But every dollar spent by the Soviet Union was a loss.
That's right. That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Now, the other question I have, you know, because I used to listen and read a lot. I listened to people like you years and years ago on the radio, and there were scores of them, and I read articles by people like you years and years ago, and there were scores of them, hundreds and hundreds of them, and the American media was filled with them. Even early television, you could get Gore Vidal on the air with William F. Buckley, and I mean, there were a lot of extremely bright people around at the time. Now they're down to the teens. They almost do not exist anymore. Now, you're a professor of media.
Yeah.
And I opened the show talking about these terrific kids that I saw, 15 and under, participating in the chip, putt, and drive contest at Augusta. Your students are probably anywhere from 17 to 18 or 22. How do they respond to the world that you're talking about?
Well, that's a very good question. And I have to say that the answer is a very hopeful one. You know, I mean, what happened to me, this reply requires that I give you a little background on what happened to me.
Definitely.
When I came out in 2005, I came out with this book, Fooled Again, which is a very careful study of how the Republicans stole the 2004 presidential election. And as I was working on this book and doing the research for it, I thought to myself, you know, this is going to be great when this comes out, because it's going to jumpstart such an important national conversation about the dangers of computerized voting. We absolutely have to get away from the system. And I figured that a careful, you know, lively book, amply documented, and if I may say so myself, you know, a lot of fun to read, would sweep the country and start this conversation. Well, I was really, really wrong to expect that kind of a response, because the book was basically murdered. It was killed. I got a total of 2 reviews in American newspapers. One was positive, one was negative. I'm someone who had formerly been invited onto every NPR show and was able to do tons of interviews on radio and TV. My book, The Bush Dyslexicon, which came out in 2001, was a bestseller. You know, it came out in June of 2001. I mean, when 9/11 came, the book was practically an arrestable offense. But I was on MSNBC pushing it, you know, and I was on all these NPR shows pushing it. Well, I really wasn't used to the kind of blackout I experienced with Fooled Again. The fact is that election fraud is on this list of taboo subjects, subjects you cannot talk about in America without being branded a kook, you know, without being relegated to the category of conspiracy theory. It's a list that includes the Kennedy assassinations and the King assassination. It includes the CIA's drug dealing in the inner cities. It includes 9/11, certainly. It now includes vaccines. It includes Zionism. I mean, there's just a list of things you can't really talk about. You're not allowed to discuss them, you know. I'm not saying that you're not allowed to take certain positions on them. I'm saying you're not allowed to talk about them at all here in this land of free speech, you know. So I became increasingly, from this experience, I became increasingly interested in how it happens that certain subjects end up taboo, despite the fact that we have a First Amendment in this country, right? How does it happen? And from there, I became interested in conspiracy theory. That is to say, that phrase. How did that phrase enter journalistic discourse? And when did it enter journalistic discourse? Was the American press always laughing off conspiracy theories? You probably know that in 1934, there was a plot to oust FDR from the White House. It's called the Business Plot, right? And General Smedley Butler, a great man, a war hero, a Marine, you know, the most decorated Marine up to that time, was actually contacted by a cabal of super rich people and, you know, Wall Street speculators and so on, who wanted him to lead an army of 500,000 war veterans to the White House, where he would depose Franklin Roosevelt.
Including Bush's grandfather.
Prescott Bush was probably involved in that. Certainly the DuPonts were involved in it. Well, at the time, you know, the press basically laughed the story off, but they never called it a conspiracy theory, you know, even though, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee ultimately found that everything Smedley Butler said was absolutely true, and it did happen. Well, as I say, I wanted to know how this came about, and let me quickly mention a book that is not published in our series. I published it in a different series called Discovering America with the University of Texas Press. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith, and it is a history of precisely how and why the phrase conspiracy theory entered journalistic discourse in this country, and then from there came to be on the tip of everybody's tongue. You know, today, how many people say...
Great story. Would you repeat the title of that book and how people can get it?
Yeah, Conspiracy Theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith. basically what happened. It's very simple. A couple of books came out in 1967 questioning the Warren Commission report. You know, one was Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. The other was Inquest by Edward J. Epstein. Very different books. You know, Epstein thought it was Castro who did it. Lane implies it was, you know, the CIA and others. Doesn't matter what their arguments were. The fact is the books came out. So what happened? The CIA sent a memo to all station chiefs worldwide instructing them to use their propaganda assets and their friends in the media to discredit the work of these two authors using the following five arguments. And then they actually lay out these arguments like, well, if there was a conspiracy, somebody would have talked by now. I mean, arguments we've heard a thousand times ever since, right? This memo went out. It's in the book. It's an appendix to the book. There's no question about its authenticity. And it was probably the most successful propaganda drive in American history, certainly, and possibly...
Operation Mockingbird. You know, back in the 70s, Senator Frank Church discovered that the CIA had 1,000, get this, Mark, 1,000 assets working in the American media. Now, that was in the 70s when they were trying to fight a war against real people, which were, of course, the Vietnamese. Can you imagine now how infiltrated our society is by CIA media assets when they're fighting phantom enemies like terrorists who don't exist? It's like Gore Vidal said, it's a war against dandruff. It doesn't exist. Anyway, quickly, because I don't want to lose you and I want to get back to the business of the students. How did the students respond to you? And something else I want to say to you. When the weather is a little warmer, and if you think they would be interested, I am going to send to you a copy of The Last Word on the Assassination, which not only includes the Garrison tapes, but it's followed. We did it at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, when Bobby Kennedy backed out at the last minute, and I got Joan Mellon, Jim Mars, and Dick Russell. They formed the most fabulous panel. And I never thought anybody could follow Garrison, but these three follow Garrison. It is the best thing ever done about the assassination. I'll send it to you. And great. If you think your students would like to see it, at my own expense, I will come back and I will screen it and I will talk to them along with you.
That sounds fabulous. I'll definitely follow through on that.
Only when the weather's warmer.
When the weather's warmer. But let me quickly answer your question, because it's a very hopeful answer, as I say. You know, I teach courses on propaganda. I teach courses on the culture industries, including the news business. So these issues come up all the time. And the terrific thing I've discovered is that this generation of young people is simply not intimidated by that accusation. To hear somebody laugh off some perfectly reasonable argument or concern as a conspiracy theory just doesn't really impress them. They are very easy to encourage to look into these things for themselves and make up their own minds. They're very receptive to this. They've outgrown the inhibition over a conspiracy theory in much the same way that they seem to have outgrown homophobia. It just doesn't mean anything to them, you know? Demographically, that kind of hatred is just disappearing, you know? So the people you were talking about at the very beginning of your show, those sort of hate mongers, people like Pat Robertson, they're like dinosaurs, you know? And I'm pleased to say that the same is the case with this uneasiness that you might sound like you're nuts if you dare just to look into things like 9/11 or the crash of TWA Flight 800 and so on. You know, it's very important for people to be genuinely skeptical and to call for new investigations of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11. Just call for new commissions so we can actually find out what happened. There's nothing wrong with that.
Do you want to know something? It's so simple, because you said that the House Un-American Committee, they discovered, even though they probably didn't want to, that the conspiracy to rid the country of FDR, because Smedley Butler was the guy that they approached and he broke the story, if it is proven that that is true, which it is, it's not so far a leap to think if they were going to do that in the 30s that they wouldn't do it on November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the notion of conspiracy theory, the notion that it's somehow unthinkable that the government would do this or that the rich would do this, it's based on a very sentimental misunderstanding of the nature of power. And it's a misunderstanding that's completely alien to the American experiment. I mean, our system is based on the assumption that power is dangerous, that power is corrupt.
It was such a delight to have you here. I mean, you're Viagra for the intellect, I must tell.
Nobody's ever said that to me before.
Well, we have to be in contact. I have to send that to you. And tell us again quickly how people can get to your site to get to these books, and then I have to say goodnight.
Okay, it's just forbiddenbookshelf.com. It's as simple as that. And that site has all the titles, all the authors, and then you can go to any of your favorite vendors of e-books and get your copies there.
Would you repeat that once more, please, Mark?
Just forbiddenbookshelf.com.
Well, thank you again so much for being here with me, and thank you so much for being where you are at New York University. All the best to you, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. Have a great night.
Thanks a lot, you too.
Bye-bye. Wow, that was wonderful. God, what a delight to talk to somebody like that. Thank you all so much. I'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Good night.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.